Thank you, Danielle. Okay.
Nothing we can do about it.
No, okay, I see. Now I'll send. This is rather very cruel to be the first immediately after the other session. I hope you're not too bored. If you are, you can leave and then be back. But I promise it's going to be about a different topic. Okay. Okay, so this paper draws on research conducted in Portugal in two different moments in time. First, a large EU-funded international research project called FEMCIT, Gender and Citizenship in Multicultural Europe, the Impact of Contemporary Youth Movements. This was a 5-year cross-national and comparative project, which ended in 2011. FEMCIT explored the relationship between the changing forms and practices of gender citizenship in multicultural Europe and the demands and practices of contemporary women's movements. We studied how citizenship is gendered and how women, as ordinary citizens and activists, have been involved in challenging inequalities and injustice across Europe. In the specific work package I was working on intimate citizenship, which was coordinated by Sasha Rosio, we have gathered information about majority and minoritized women in Bulgaria, Norway, Portugal, and the UK. Our concern then was to look at the ways in which non-conventional people were experiencing the possibilities of full intimate citizenship on different levels, formally in law and social policy, collectively through cultural recognition and the impact of social movements, and on an individual basis by gathering biographical interviews, accounts. The second moment on which this paper draws is actually ongoing. It's a research project called Disabled Intimacies, Sexual and Reproductive Citizenship of Disabled Women in Portugal. Gathering a team of five researchers, one of them is actually here, under my coordination. This is a 2-year study hosted at the Center for Social Studies, University of Coimbra, and funded by the Portuguese Foundation for Science and Technology. So, theoretically informed by feminist disability studies, we concur with the idea that women in general, and disabled women in particular, face daily legal, economic, and social cultural challenges that hinder their ability to become full intimate citizens. Taking into account the multiple ways in which disabled women relate to the spheres of sexuality and reproduction, including opportunities, constraints, expectations, and representations, we are interested in a range of issues within these two strands, sexuality and reproduction. So, as you can see there, for instance, in sexuality, we'll be covering issues such as marriage, cohabitation, non-cohabiting relationships, sexuality as a single person, the right to pleasure, self-determination. In the strand which deals with reproduction or motherhood, we'll be looking at biological motherhood, but also adoption, co-parenting and fostering, surrogacy and assisted conception. There's also a third strand in which we'll be interviewing, we haven't gone that far yet, we'll be interviewing professionals and also family members of disabled women as mediators for the access to full intimate citizenship. Drawing heavily on the life histories elicited by the use of biographic narrative interviews, we explore the intimate lives of disabled women, the challenges to self-determination, the lived experiences of social, cultural, legal, and economic discrimination, and strategies used to overcome disabling obstacles. So fieldwork hasn't finished yet, but many of the interviews display several of the features we have already come across in the FEMCIT project, namely in relation to the culturally dominant expectation around couple, which is the main topic of my talk this afternoon. So I had a little bit of setting the scene, but you've heard it during the keynote. So I'm going to, if you don't mind, I'm going to just not mention it again, because, the dictatorship, okay? So the historical centrality of coupledom to the Portuguese intimate citizenship regime is rooted in clearly differentiated gender roles which have served to curtail women's agency and to attach it compulsorily to the private sphere. Intimacy has historically been socially controlled and legally enacted based on conservative religious principles that outlawed reproductive rights and non-normative sexuality, whilst enshrining monogamy, children, and heterosexual marriage. Despite recent legal changes regarding intimate and reproductive citizenship, decades of heterosexual couple-centered laws amount to the strong cultural expectation that adults should be heterosexually partnered, if not legally married. Not to have a proper partner after a certain age represents a delay in meeting normative life landmarks, an embarrassing failure, something that should have been avoided. The importance of couple-centered reproductive and heterosexual family units within dominant Portuguese culture is also produced and reproduced by law and social laws. The cases under discussion in this paper illustrate how the couple norm remains solid, even if some of its elements have shifted significantly in recent years. But they also speak of resistance and critique, opening up the ground for subverting, rejecting, or confronting the unspoken rule of couple. So the first case I bring to you is that of Luisa. She's in her late 40s, she's a Roma woman. And I called it Being Single as the Only Way Out. Luisa was born in the early 60s in southern Portugal, during the depression. Her father was a market seller and her mother was a housewife selling occasionally. She stopped school at the age of 11. At age 29, she got a driving license and started selling as a means of living. In the late 90s, she got involved in the educational sector. After getting a full-time job as a babysitter, she finished the obligatory schooling years. Luisa's story illustrates the tensions between tradition and modernity, norms and expectations. When she was growing up, marriage was a requirement to become an adult, even if not an autonomous adult in the case of women. Therefore, as a young Roma woman, Luisa was supposed to get married. However, she deliberately chose not to, as she could not find the sort of relationship that would match her standards and expectations. She says, "I constructed my own love story. It would have to be with someone who I cared for, with love, much love. But at that time, in my ethnicity, there was no such thing. So if anyone would look at me or say something to me, I would pretend I had nothing to do with that. I would get over." Since an early age, Luisa learned that the worst danger was to become badly spoken of, that people would spread rumors about her and her family. That could seriously hinder Luisa's possibilities of getting herself a good husband. But she also learned that cultural norms could be bent, given the right arguments. And so when she was in her late 20s, she pursued her mother to allow her to take a driving license, arguing that this could be a means for surviving later on in life. She passed the exam straight away, and it was her father who bought her first car. Even this decision was interpreted in relation to her failure to succeed at coupledom as she was expected to. So you can see the second quote. "I took the driving license and there was a big whoa." Like, why would she want the driving license if she is in the age of getting married? Luisa underlined this connection between being independent, on one hand, and conceding to a submissive marriage, on the other. She carried on. "After a certain age, am I going to put up with a man? I already had my driving license. I was already independent. I can't be bothered. My life is already so full. A gypsy man giving me orders, having to obey his rules, maybe even be beaten on top of that? No, not in this age. I've got my job. If I was married, the husband would not allow me to work, then I wouldn't be able to walk around as much. I'm not into that, not into that. I want to help people. I want a different life from that. I'm really not into that." This narrative of selfhood and autonomy goes parallel with an ongoing sense of grief about having remained single in a context in which coupledom is the dominant rule. "I didn't make any effort in finding the prince on his white horse. Sometimes I say I regret not having married because I'm no longer a young person. And if I had married, perhaps I'd have my children, my husband, and people who could renew me. And now if I die, I don't leave anything behind." So although Luisa's case challenges the expectation that adults should be coupled, her narrative is also tinged with regret and sadness. highlighting the extent to which the couple norm remains solid. It seems that Louisa remains single because she was born ahead of her time. The couple norm was perceived to be simply too strong to be undone. Second case. Caterina, early 30s, Cape Verdean. She had several older sisters and brothers, some of which from previous relationships, of her strong-minded and hard-working mother. When she was 21, Caterina moved to Lisbon to carry on with her studies. She has had several short-term relationships. She's single and she's got many friends. She sees herself as adopting children and having her own biological child, either in an independent production or with a close friend. She never dreamed about getting married, and she never had long-term relationships. Based on what her female friends tell her, she believes the maximum time she could hold on next to a man would be 1 year, except if he was able to make her laugh after all that time. One of the most salient aspects of Caterina's interview was the self-reflexive tone of the narrative she offered about her life, displaying an ironic take on what she perceived as the dominant norm in intimacy. She was very open about her one-night stand relationships and how that worked to empower her. Caterina takes it as it is, fun, pleasure, uncompromised sexual encounters. She describes this as the McDonald's love. As she explains, you get there, you order, you eat, you digest, you go back there again, you order again, blah, blah, blah. And when you have enough, you change to Kentucky Fried Chicken. And you keep on doing that. End of quote. But that said, she also recognizes how draining it becomes because of dominant expectations, which soon become your own. And I won't have time to go into that. Caterina's story highlights the tensions between expectations and facts. It is mostly a dialogue between the real and the imaginary, in which she tries to position herself and to justify her choices. During her interview, she offered many examples of critical thinking about coupledom and how constraining sexual morals and expectations become.
So, to be brief. She mentions, you know, people coming to her and asking, so when are you getting married? You know, when are you having kids? Or are you a dyke? Because she hasn't done any of that, you know, but that final question no one asks. Okay. In one of her accounts, Caterina recognizes her own expectations of being coupled, even if this idea becomes nuanced by her own self-reflexive experience. She says, well, I'm not looking for a prince. I am looking for someone who can go on completing me. It doesn't have to be one person. It can be several people in different moments in my life. So there is this person missing, one who would fit, the missing piece in the puzzle. But then this person does not exist. Rather, there are several pieces of the puzzle, and then there are many puzzles that you fit, many objects, and then you like aspects of each of them, and then you can't mix them all up and make your own milkshake. Caterina epitomizes the tension between a liberated, individualized woman, on one hand, and someone who partially incorporates the demands of the procreative and couple norms. The final case. Marilyn, late 30s, Bulgarian, married.
Let me just say something which I forgot. For the sake of anonymity, all the names have been changed, the nationalities, blah, 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 so you don't take it as it is. Marilyn was born with a congenital condition that impacted on her physical mobility. She had a rather lonely childhood with private classes at home after being rejected from accessing regular school by the headmaster based on her condition. Her upbringing was very conservative with strict gender roles. Women should remain caste and protect themselves from seductive, reckless men who may get you pregnant and then leave. As she grew up, she stopped being afraid of men. So she says, I knew it would be me to decide about my own body, not boys. And the argument, if you'd love me, you'd sleep with me, was never an issue, because it did not strike me as a condition for love. When I want may be different from when the boy wants. And actually, my first erotic encounters were with women, with girls, not boys. Not sure why, really. Not sure whether this is because I am a little bisexual. She carried on the topic of women as sexual partners. At some point, I felt a relationship with a girl was safer than with a boy, because I feel very equal. Whereas with boys, I was never sure whether he was trying to humiliate me or seduce me and then leave. With girls, I didn't feel like that, never felt guilty. I enjoyed it very much.
As a young adult, Marilyn decided to focus on her studies and dated no one. After finishing her first degree, she started dating an older man. She broke up when she accidentally found out he was married. The centrality of coupledom becomes evident in this episode. Not Marilyn's drive towards coupledom, but what she calls an ethical sense of responsibility towards protecting other people's coupledom from disruption. She said, "For me, it would not have been acceptable to carry on the relationship after learning he had a wife." Coupledom here emerges as somewhat sacred, rising above Marilyn's own sexual desires. Despite feeling safer with women and enjoying lesbian relationships very much, Marilyn has self-identified as heterosexual, and she's married to a man. And in fact, that has happened to every single woman who was at some point sexually involved with Marilyn. These women, who remained close friends, advanced the centrality of coupledom. So she says, there is a dominant view amongst her women friends, which really annoys me and frustrates me, that a woman cannot and should not be alone, cannot be single, or she'll lose market value. And so each of these women has her more or less happy relationship, in some cases rather unhappy, but they endure because they must. Because when you're 32, 33, 34, 35, you can't be on your own. The family will ask, what about a boyfriend? When are you having kids? And so I get the feeling that these women accept to be with someone because it's what will look better in the picture, because it must be done so. Marilyn detaches herself from these women, as she decided to focus on her studies instead, rather than giving it all up for a man who might tell her one day she should be grateful for having a husband willing to stay with her despite her impairment. Therefore, it was only after finishing her postgraduate course that she met a man with whom she decided to marry. To conclude, 1 minute. So, this paper has been inspired by the voices of three women across a range of diversities: disability, ethnicity, nationality, sexual orientation, age group, formal education, social class, marital status. Despite these many levels of belonging and difference, they share the common legacy linked to the experience of being minoritized in the dominant context of collectively imagined as white, able-bodied, heterosexual Portuguese people. Many of the topics and arguments that characterize the feminist critique of norms and expectations regarding intimacy were present in the discourses of these three minoritized women. The counter-normative intimate scripts that these women offer only became thinkable after the post-revolutionary feminist intellectual and political work, parallel to the changing landscape of law and social policy in the fields of gender and sexuality in recent decades. The social legal transformation of Portugal have also played a significant role in the range of opportunities available to people trying to live outside the norm. Despite their differences, the individual biographies and narratives of these three women speak about the particularities and changes in intimate citizenship regimes. They exemplify how personal lives are shaped by and potentially subversive of the dominant social cultural norms. They also illustrate what seems to be a contemporary tendency that could be described as a widespread and profound ambivalence about the cohabiting couple form. And because I was so into this quote, I couldn't resist it, and so I just put it there again. But to be, not to repeat precisely the same as I did in the keynote, I call your attention to a bit I decided to erase from the slide in the morning that goes, you know, towards the middle of the second paragraph. It says, the scare stories about single people dying earlier or loneliness becoming a pandemic must be seen in the larger context of a social order that is hostile to non-couples and an economic order which the collective good seems to be anathema. Our own imaginations and hearts can come up with that. Thank you very much.